Welcome to Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler. I'm Kent Blanford. Each week, we'll bring you a sampling of some of the best Catholic podcasts being prepared and shared out there on the internet. Today, I want to break one of my own self-imposed rules and share with you two podcasts from the same source. The good folks who, along with Bishop Robert Barron, provide the Word on Fire podcasts. First up, we have Bishop Barron and Brandon Vogt reviewing the rise and fall of the new atheism.
Name one ancient culture that would believe in, you know, all you need is love, as John Lennon also said with the Beatles, and the brotherhood of man. Those are Christian ideas, inescapably so. So you can't say on the one hand, imagine no religion, you know, no hell below us, above us only sky. No God. But boy, oh boy, do we want the brotherhood of man. You can't do that. That doesn't work. The brotherhood of man follows from the fatherhood of God. And that's an old Christian idea.
Welcome back to the Word on Fire show. I'm Brandon Vogt, the host and the senior publishing director at Word on Fire. How did the so-called new atheism rise so quickly in the early 2000s? What made people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens so popular and effective? And how did this new atheist movement decline and end almost as quickly over the past few years? Those are the topics we'll be discussing today with Bishop Robert Barron, who joins us from Rochester, Minnesota. Bishop, good to be with you.
Hey, Brandon, good morning to you.
You recently rolled back in from Harvard, of all places, one of the premier Ivy League institutions. What were you doing there, and how did it go?
They invited me to do the opening of the year Mass, the Mass of the Holy Spirit, for the Catholic community of Harvard. And there's a gorgeous church there called St. Paul's, which I'd heard about but never actually had seen. Beautifully decorated church, and they have this kids choir of kids. They're very sophisticated young people who sing at a very high level. So it was a beautiful place to see and to hear. So I preached there. I preached the Mass for the Holy Spirit. And then that afternoon, I went to, it's called Memorial Church. It's the main sort of classically Protestant church at the heart of Harvard Yard. And about 1,000 people, they say, gathered there, jammed that church. And I gave a talk on the Catholic intellectual tradition. So it was just a joy. I loved that day. It was a busy day and a very full day. Saw the dorm where both FDR and JFK were students, saw the room where Mark Zuckerberg was when he was at Harvard, the chapel still standing where the young John Adams would have worshipped. So it's a beautiful place to go. I've been to Harvard a couple times, but it was my most thorough kind of immersion in it.
I'm just delighted to hear that there was such a big Catholic response to a religious figure coming in. You usually hear, especially at these Ivy League institutions, they've been secularized. There's no place for religion. So the fact that they welcomed you with such a big crowd is really encouraging.
It was. Yeah, it was to me.
Well, today I want to start by really recommending and then discussing this brand new book. It's by a friend of ours named Justin Brierley. He is the longtime host of the Unbelievable radio show in the UK, which you've been on before, I think a couple times. But he wrote this excellent new book called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. I know you've read a big chunk of it, as have I, and I'm hoping we can do a series of discussions on the podcast using this as the leaping off point. But today I just want to focus on the opening chapter, which details the rise and fall of the new atheism movement. This movement has long been an adversary of War on Fire, of your work, your videos and writings over the years. So let's just start with defining it. What is the new atheism? What made it new? And how is it different than your classical Enlightenment atheism?
I always see the new atheism, which emerged in the early zeros, right, as a post 9/11 phenomenon. So 9/11 happens, 2001, and it revived this old Enlightenment trope that religion, in the measure that it's irrational, is violent. So because you can't adjudicate your dispute through debate and argument, the only way you can do it is through violence. And think of Enlightenment figures, you know, from Voltaire to Thomas Jefferson, who would say that about religion. It's the source of much of our, you know, the violence in the world. So that was revived for obvious reasons after 9/11. So here's these religious people who are crashing airplanes into buildings and killing thousands of people. That's the problem with religion. And then that event was articulated by some, I would call them remarkably gifted rhetoricians. And here, you know, Christopher Hitchens comes to mind, obviously. One of the most rhetorically gifted people of the last, you know, 25 years. Richard Dawkins, I won't comment on him as a scientist. I'm not qualified to, but certainly as a kind of popular rhetorician, someone that knew how to appeal to emotion and stir up people's, you know, feelings. Sam Harris, another good example, a bright man, but basically a rhetorician. Daniel Dennett, so the four horsemen of the New Atheism were people who I think fueled by their native anti-religiosity and then encouraged deeply by September 11th and then using their extraordinary rhetorical gifts stirred up in a lot of people a visceral emotional reaction against religion. Now, they used arguments to be sure, but to be fair and honest, they're pretty bad arguments or rehearsals of old atheist tropes from a long time ago. What was new about them, it seems to me, was their nastiness and the sort of naked appeal to emotion and stirring up people's visceral anti-religiosity. That was what was new about it, seems to me. Not the arguments as such, which are actually rather old and tired. I'll say this, you know, our ministry, I think my Word on Fire ministry really begins at that same time, right around the year 2000. I started doing internet work, you know, 2006, 2007, right at the time when the New Atheists were very much in vogue. And so I confronted right away armies of young people that had been evangelized by the New Atheists. And, you know, I see it now maybe as it's an expression of the divine providence that our work commenced right when there was this enormous animosity toward religion. But to answer your question, I think that's what was new about them was post-September 11th, the kind of nasty, provocative, rhetorical style of these authors and the fact that they did influence large swaths of young people.
I know a lot of commentators look at the rise of the New Atheism and ask themselves, why did it arise when and where it did? And you've hinted at one of the major causes, the 9/11 attacks. In his book, Justin Brierley looks at two other contributing causes. One was the rising culture war dialogue around religion and science, particularly debates about evolution curriculum in America. And then thirdly, the rise of the internet and social media. Yeah. Talk about those latter two, the faith and science, internet, social media. How did these fuel the New Atheism?
Well, the social media thing, and we've talked a lot about this, has a positive side and a negative side. Negatively, you know, how views can sweep through entire populations, you know, very quickly. And because of the nature of social media, they tend to be rather superficial. So people making comments and a quick reaction and largely emotional response. And I came across that, Brandon, early on when I do a video talking about God. And then I'd be met with these, you know, we call them trolls now, I suppose, but met with this, you know, visceral, deeply emotional kind of reaction. And I was frankly surprised by that, naively, I see now. But, you know, I was expecting Bertrand Russell level engagement, you know, serious counter arguments. But I met with this wave of largely emotionally driven superficiality. That was a product of social media, I think, for sure. And that contributed to the New Atheist wave. The science thing, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been talking about that for years. When I say we, religious people, we dropped the ball on that, I think. We allowed that conversation to be taken over by evangelists for a scientism and a materialism. And that was a huge problem. As I've said a million times, we religious people have nothing against the sciences. What we do stand against is the philosophical perspective of scientism or materialism that says reality is simply coextensive with what can be seen and measured, you know, empirically. Well, that's a highly controversial philosophical position to take, and one that is very hard actually to justify. But we did allow the conversation, I think, to get hijacked and co-opted by those who were coming from that perspective. And what they did is they made religion seem then silly and primitive and pre-scientific and mythological. And that was, of course, used by all the new atheists. Dawkins was a scientist. Dennett's a scientist. Sam Harris is a neurologist, right? He's a brain. Hitchens is a journalist. But the other three were scientists. And they used that, I'd call it, deeply mistaken view, that materialism is simply self-evident because of what the sciences have discovered.
So you uploaded your first YouTube video in 2007, which, as you noted mm-hmm. earlier, was right in the sweet spot of when this new atheism was arising.
Yeah.
In fact, from 2006 to 2008, the bookend years, all four of these new atheist horsemen released best-selling books denouncing God. So Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion. Christopher Hitchens, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Sam Harris, Letter to a Christian Nation. And Daniel Dennett, Breaking the Spell, Religion as Natural Phenomenon. Each of these books sold hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of copies, massively popular, especially among young people. I remember I was in college at this time, seeing so many college kids in the library, on campus with these books. Why do you think young people responded so eagerly to these new atheist materials?
Because of I'll be judgmental here, but the superficiality and the very highly rhetorical style of these books. So that will appeal to someone who doesn't have a real critical edge, hasn't considered these questions deeply. You read, like Dawkins or Hitchens, for example, both, bright men to be sure, but their characterization of religion was just absolutely a straw man. It betrayed zero sense of a sophisticated approach to the Bible or to theological questions. But they were so rhetorically gifted that a lot of young people were swept up in it. Secondly, and this is as old as Adam and Eve. What I mean is there's always a kind of resentment against religion because religion speaks of God and God's demand. Well, at some deep level, all of us sinners, we don't want that. We don't want God making demands on it. We don't want God telling us how we should live. We don't want a very objective moral norm hovering in front of us. I'd rather live my life on my own terms. So someone comes along and in a at least rhetorically persuasive way says, there is no God. Religion's all nonsense. There is no God. Well, there's a kind of permanently adolescent side of me that will always say, hey, great. Great. Now I can live the way I want to live. I think there was a lot of that too in the popularity of these figures.
So the new atheists had a heyday for about a decade. It wasn't until the early to mid 2010s that you begin to see the new atheism dwindle and then ultimately, I think it's safe to say, fall apart. Justin Brierley traces a lot of this out in his book. There were scandals and infighting among the many atheist and secular groups, complaints about the leaders being all old white men. But Brierley also points to this interesting tension that eventually broke. He said, on the one hand, these new atheists like to present themselves with tremendous bravado and arrogance. In fact, some of them called themselves the Brights, in contrast to the dulls, the religious people.
Yeah, they were supremely
confident. But on the other side, they seem to also be supremely cowardly. I know that during these years, it was one of your own gripes about the new atheists that they refused to debate some of the leading religious lights, people like William Lane Craig, and instead would pick on the least sophisticated, the easiest religious people and arguments. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll give Hitchens credit. He did debate Craig, and I think Sam Harris did too. There's a famous debate at Notre Dame. And, watch the Hitchens-Craig conversations, because what I've noticed in them, I think Hitchens, almost despite himself, was impressed by William Lane Craig and knew that he was dealing with a formidable opponent. And he realized, okay, my rhetorical games aren't going to work with this guy. And so they all relied on you know, their usual tropes, but they didn't work with someone as serious as Craig. And so I think those are kind of instructive. And I wonder, too, and this is, you know, part of Brierley's argument, that as formerly agnostic and atheist people begin to take a deeper, closer look at religion, was it because the new atheists, in their bravado, as you say, summoned us again to pick up our game? You know, now this goes back to one of my themes that makes some Catholics mad, but it's simply the case that we dumbed ourselves down for so long. We dropped all those tools, all those weapons, which I don't hesitate to call them, the weapons that we can use to fight off those who are trying to attack us. And in the measure that we left all that to the side, we were defenseless. When these superficial attacks were coming at us, we weren't able to defend ourselves. I think as the new atheists did engage serious religious people, you know, something began to shift in them. And they realized, oh, wait a minute, maybe we are being too abrupt here. Maybe we aren't being sufficiently reflective. And that's, I think, an interesting part of Brierley's story.
Brierley seems to agree with you. In fact, he provocatively says at one point, "I thank God for Richard Dawkins. Our harshest critics are often the ones who help us to grow the most." He says, "New atheism has revitalized the intellectual tradition of the Christian church in the West." Would you agree with that?
Yeah, right. Certainly at the apologetic level. And I press it too, Brandon, because I would say to theologians operating at a very high level, university theologians, that they lost their connection to the living church and the connection to apologetics. Go back to Thomas Aquinas, who is a theologian at the very highest level of, you know, speculative systematic theology. At the same time, and because of the first, he's also a great apologist. I think we drove a wedge between apologetics and high speculative theology, where our best university people didn't engage these attacks on the church at all, it seems to me. Craig is the great counterexample. So I think that's a good development from it, that we need to reintegrate our high university speculative theology and on-the-ground apologetics. You know, I want Jean-Luc Marion and David Tracy and those people in the front lines of apologetics, and not just entertaining the highest, most abstract questions. So I think in all those ways, it has awakened us, yeah.
I can mention just one more reason that Brierley gives for the collapse of the new atheism. He notes that it's essentially parasitic, that it has nothing positive to offer, that at the end of the day, it failed to satisfy the longings of its adherents. Let me read you a couple paragraphs that he wrote. He said, "Many people had turned to the new atheism for its promise of a brighter, more rational, and more scientific future. They believed it held the key to human flourishing, just as the secular anthem, Imagine, had envisioned a world without religion, heaven, or hell. It was only reasonable to suppose that the song's utopian brotherhood of man would naturally follow. Yet, despite John Lennon claiming it was easy if you try, it turned out to be quite complicated. What could a movement that was built on tearing down God erect in his place? Science was the obvious alternative. Surely that was an objective truth to which all people could aspire. But science turned out to be a poor substitute for a savior. Science can tell you how the universe arose, but not why it is there. It cannot purchase a meaningful existence." I think he's getting on a really key insight that the new atheism was really effective at causing people to doubt God's existence and the goodness of religion, but very bad at providing any satisfying alternative. Yeah. Would you agree?
No, quite right. I go back to Tom Holland here. You know, his great work has been showing that the great ethical values of the West that we say, oh, they're grounded in the Enlightenment, in fact, are inescapably Christian values. Now, link that to John Lennon. So, you know, the brotherhood of man. Did Julius Caesar believe in the brotherhood of man? Tom Holland, who knows the Roman world as well as anybody, say, absolutely not. Would the ancient Greeks have believed in the brotherhood of man? Absolutely not. Name one ancient culture that would believe in, you know, all you need is love, as John Lennon also said with the Beatles, and the brotherhood of man. Those are Christian ideas, inescapably so. So you can't say on the one hand, imagine no religion, you know, no hell below us, above us only sky. No God. But boy, oh boy, do we want the brotherhood of man. You can't do that. That doesn't work. The brotherhood of man follows from the fatherhood of God. And that's an old Christian idea. Holland, I think, is as good as anyone today at showing that relationship. And so the new atheists wanted the brotherhood of man business, but they sawed off the branch they were sitting on, right? And then science, right, is a very poor substitute. The physical sciences are great. We love them. And they make our lives much more convenient because of technology, and they give us insight into, you know, the planets. And all that is great. But they won't tell you one little thing about the meaning of your life, the purpose of your life, what makes life beautiful, what makes life morally upright, what's the ultimate purpose of my existence. The sciences won't give you that. Finally, you're a new atheist and say, there's no God. And young people, all right, you know, stick it to religion. And, oh, yeah, we want to get rid of all that. And what am I left with? I came from nothing. I'm going to nothing. There's no objective value that determines the meaning of my life. And I'm stuck in an existential desert. That's where the new atheism, like the old atheism, has left me. And so once I get over the kind of my adolescent, you know, sense of triumph, that's what I'm left with. Now, welcome into the picture the Jordan Petersons and the Tom Hollands and the Douglas Murrays and people who maybe would have identified as agnostic or even atheist and are starting to say, now, wait a minute. There's something in this religious thing that's not just stupid superstition and oppression and, you know, religion poisons everything, that maybe there actually is something to what the great religions have been saying. And that's the moment I think Brierley identifies correctly as where we are right now. We're at kind of a turning point moment.
Yeah, I think that's, to me, the most fascinating part of Brierley's book is he's pinpointed this reality that the new atheism has become tired and spent, and the church shouldn't spend its time wasting away by arguing with the Dawkins and the Hitchens of the world and their acolytes today. But we've got this new vanguard of interesting skeptics and non-believers. You've mentioned several names already: Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray, Tom Holland, Dave Rubin, many of whom you've had conversations with. Yeah, Brierley has as well. And what Brierley notes is that these guys are asking different questions. They're interested in different things, posing different challenges than the new atheists of before. In your own interaction with these figures, have you noticed that shift as well, that there's a new interest, a new type of question being asked?
You know, go back to Dave Rubin, because I've been on with him a number of times, I think three or four times. The very first time was out in L.A., and I was on his show. And at that point, he was an atheist and said so, and told me he climbed to the top of Mount Sinai because he, from his Jewish background, he was interested in doing that. And he said, you know what happened when I got to the top? Nothing. I felt nothing. And so he announced himself as an atheist to me, you know, unapologetically. Well, I think it was the second or third time I was on with him. I casually said, and I didn't mean it in any way to be critical. I just said, well, you know, now, Dave, for you as an atheist to say that, that's rather interesting. And he paused and he said, I don't think I'm an atheist anymore, you know? And that's when I realized, okay, something has shifted around. Now, what was happening was he was traveling at that time with Jordan Peterson, who was talking a lot about, I mean, obviously about God. He's talking about the Bible, about the, you know, spiritual dimension of life. And I think it had a big impact on Dave Rubin. And then Peterson himself, of course, is a prime example of this. A guy with a very scientific background, but who started to read and think his way toward what the great religions have been talking about.
Well, I'd like to encourage everybody, again, to pick up Justin Brierley's new book, The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, because what I'd like to do is for future conversations, walk through some of the additional chapters in the book where he notes the questions that skeptical seekers are asking in regards to science, culture, history, and the Bible. So maybe we can have a separate conversation about each one of those topics. Well, it's time now for our listener question. If you have a question that you'd like to ask Bishop Barron on this show, you can send it in to us at the website askbishopbarron.com. A woman named Mary from Minnesota has done just that. She submitted a question for the bishop about the Holy Spirit. Here's Mary's question.
Hi, Bishop Barron. This is Mary from Minnesota. Thank you for your good work. I am calling to ask, does the Catholic Church teach that the Holy Spirit has a gender? Thank you, and God bless.
Yeah, thanks for that question. The answer obviously is no. God is a spirit. God's not material, and gender is associated with our bodies, and so God doesn't have a gender. God is not male or female. Now that begs the question, how come we use, you know, pronouns? We use the he, him pronoun when talking about God. The classical answer is that God, who's actus purus, right, pure act, God who's the creator, God's the one who generates and gives rise to the world. God is that reality which can never be receptive, right? A creature can't affect God as though God is moved by a creature. So classically speaking, we associate the male with the generative side of a sexual act, the female with a receptive side. And I think that's why in the Bible and the great tradition, we associate the masculine pronoun with God. Now, to say that is by no means to imply that we can't use metaphors for God that are more feminine. So the Bible indeed talks about God in a more maternal way and as a hen and so on, and nursing with delight at her breasts and this sort of thing. Fine, fine. I think we can say God is like a woman. God is like a mother, you know, because God is beyond anything creaturely. So we reach for all sorts of metaphors to describe God. And so it's to use the masculine pronouns about God is by no means to be anti-woman or to say that, you know, men are, we're deifying the male gender and all that stuff. That's not the case at all. But I would say, strictly speaking, no person of the Trinity has a gender because God is beyond the physical.
Well, thanks, Mary, for that question. Today, we are launching a new book at Word on Fire. It is called Know Thyself, Catholic Classical Education and the Discovery of Self. It's written by Andrew Youngblood. If you're a parent, a teacher, a catechist, and you've heard about the classical education movement, you've been wondering what it's all about, this is the book for you. There has been an ongoing resurgence in classical education, especially among Catholics. And this classical model, which is rooted in the Socratic method, is flourishing. Classical Catholic schools are sprouting up everywhere, but it also has its detractors. Some parents and teachers worry that it's impractical, outdated, or worse, judgmental. In this book, Andrew Youngblood, who is an educator with decades of experience in classical learning as both a student and a teacher, introduces readers to this exciting educational alternative and its intellectual and spiritual benefits through brief vignettes, personal anecdotes from students and teachers, and examples from the classroom. Know Thyself makes a positive case for an education journey that teaches students to see themselves through God's eyes and truly know themselves as they are called to be. Again, the book is called Know Thyself, Catholic Classical Education and the Discovery of Self by Andrew Youngblood. I'll include a link in the show notes. Well, thanks so much for watching and listening. We'll see you next time on the Word on Fire show.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler, and we'll be back with more right after this short break.
A dash of joy, a hint of hope, a lot of love. Mixed thoroughly with deep faith, it's our recipe for a life well lived. Served fresh, daily. Catholic Radio Indy.
A little motherly advice from Marcy Rankin from CelebrateMarriageMinistry.com.
As a mother of six, it's easy to get distracted by, well, by the children. I enjoy listening to Catholic Radio Indy because it helps me remain centered in my faith. When I'm on the way to get the kids from school, or whether I am running errands every day, I can listen to shows like Dr. Anders talking about the richness and fullness of our faith, Dr. Ray Gurundi giving great advice and encouragement to parents and families, and as well as the Local Faith in Action program that features local people just living their faith in their daily lives. It's a great tool, and I hope that you can recommend it to all the moms that you know.
Covering life from a position of good news. Share the joy. Listen for updates. Discover life. Catholic Radio Indy.
Do you like game shows? How about trivia? You're listening to Catholic Radio, so I assume you're interested in the Catholic Church. Catholic Challenge 2.0 is the newest addition to our programming lineup here on Catholic Radio Indy. A 30-minute quiz show covering almost everything Catholic. Catholic Challenge 2.0 tests your knowledge and teaches at the same time. Check it out every Thursday afternoon at 4:30 right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Next up on The Sampler, we turn again to the Word on Fire podcast series as Brandon Vogt is joined by Haley Stewart, the editor of Word on Fire Spark, a new offering of great books specifically for young readers.
Welcome to this special interview. I'm Brandon Vogt, the Senior Publishing Director at Word on Fire, and today I'm joined by my longtime friend and colleague, Haley Stewart. Haley is the author of several award-winning books, including the Sister Serafina Mysteries, which are detective stories featuring a community of mouse nuns who live under the floorboard of G.K. Chesterton's house. Yes, it is as delightful as it sounds. Haley, besides being an author, is also a longtime blogger and podcaster. She hosts the Word on Fire Book Club inside of our Word on Fire Institute. But today, we're going to be discussing Haley's role as the editor of Word on Fire Spark. Word on Fire Spark. This is our new imprint of books at Word on Fire for young readers. Spark being a little flame, so it's for small people. And Haley heads up Word on Fire Spark. She's the editor. She's been working behind the scenes now for almost a couple of years, preparing a ton of beautiful, interesting books that will be coming soon from Spark. So, Haley, welcome. It's great to be with you and to talk about this exciting new initiative.
Thanks, Brandon. Yeah, I'm so excited to talk about everything we have in the works with Spark.
Let's start off with your background. Tell us about your experience with kids' books. Were you always a reader growing up? What were some of your favorite books as a child?
I was always a reader. I loved to read, and I got really into classics, fantasy, and historical fiction were kind of my favorites. So I loved Madeline L'Engle's Time Quintet, A Wrinkle in Time, and then the books in that series. I loved the Anne of Green Gables series by Lucy Maud Montgomery. One of my favorites was The Girl of the Limberlost by Jean Stratton Porter, which is a little bit lesser known. And then The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings kind of got me into fantasy with J.R.R. Tolkien's books. So I was a big reader, loved to read, and kind of tried out a bunch of different genres.
Now, you've long been interested in children's literature from, we might call it, a professional perspective through your authorship, your blogging, your podcasting, but you're also a mother with several kids. As a mother, how would you assess the current landscape of children's books? What's good? What's missing?
Sure. Well, I don't want to put too dark, you know, paint with too dark a brush about the state of children's literature. There are still a lot of good books being published. I just read a beautiful book by Daniel Neyeri for young adults called Everything Sad is Untrue. And it was just incredible and kind of gives you hope that, okay, everything's not as bad as it seems. Really beautiful books are still being published. But I think there are two pretty widespread problems. And I think one of them is a lack of respect for the child reader. So the problems that come along with that are, you know, bad writing, illustrations that aren't attractive, just not good quality because there's not this respect for the person reading the book. Madeline Lingle is one of my favorite writers. And one of the things she says that I think is so important and kind of is how I try to operate Spark is she says, if it's not good enough for grownups, it's not good enough for children. So really having that sense that the person reading the book is important, is intelligent, and we have to respect that reader. So part of that has to do with quality. And the other piece, I think, with respecting the child reader is you'll often see books that weren't really written for the child. You know, there may be a book trying to present a certain idea that a parent is going to feel good about purchasing, but didn't really have the child in mind at the heart of the project. So that's something I think you see a lot if you go to Barnes & Noble and kind of look around at what books are being displayed. But then the other thing I think is of concern is that it feels like the vast majority of middle grade and young adult fiction is very dystopian. And I don't think that's necessarily bad. There's some great dystopian novels that really spark great conversations. You know, my son read The Giver by Lois Lowry that he really wanted to talk about those ideas. And I think that's fantastic. But I think that also we have to kind of balance those dystopian themes with some themes of Christian hope. Otherwise, it's really kind of offering a picture of despair to our children, that everything's crumbling, everything's terrible, and this is the kind of world we live in. And so I think it's really important to balance that out with the kind of hope that we see in, say, Lord of the Rings. It's not that everything is fine. There's big problems that we have to wrestle with. But the last chapter of the story is going to be not one of despair and decline, but is going to be one of hope. And so I think that that is something that is kind of missing to some degree out there and is part of our mission at Spark to offer something better.
As you say, a lot of those principles, a child-centric experience with reading, an emphasis on Christian virtue, especially the virtue of hope, are some of the distinguishing marks of this new imprint that we're releasing, Word on Fire Spark. I mentioned that we've been working on this for a couple of years now, and we've got several books coming soon. And we do want to talk about some of those specific books. But for now, tell us a little bit about Word on Fire Spark itself. How did it come to be? What's it about?
Sure. Well, Word on Fire Publishing has been publishing great books, trying to communicate the gospel. So it's a message of evangelization and books that evangelists should read. And so with that in mind, children, as they're learning to understand the world and kind of form all their ideas, this is such a crucial time to be reaching children and to be preparing them to receive the gospel and understand the world in these gospel terms. And so it just seemed very key to start publishing books for children that are of really high quality, respecting the child reader, kind of preparing their hearts for the gospel message.
Now, there's lots of publishers of children's books, even within the Catholic world, lots of children's publishers. So what would you say is unique about Word on Fire Spark? Unique about its vision, its mission, the types of books it publishes? What stands out?
Sure. I mean, I think that as a parent who has purchased and read a lot of Catholic books with my children, I think that what you often see are kind of teaching books, which are not bad. It's good to have a teaching book, and children are often going to learn something from a book. But I think that something that Word on Fire Spark really highlights in our books is to be very story-centric. And that's because, you know, God is an artist. He's a storyteller, and he's wired us to learn about him, the world, ourselves, through stories. That's why Jesus tells parables, just how human beings are made. And so that's really kind of at the center of our books, is trying to really share a good story that's going to really engage the child. And that's how any kind of beautiful message is going to be communicated. And then the other distinguishing thing about Spark is we're just so focused on leading with beauty. So that means the illustrations are gorgeous. the writing is going to be just the highest quality, the most wonderful writers, the design is going to be just beautiful. And so that leading with beauty, that story-centric mission, and that's still kind of all around that idea of respecting the child reader, that the child reading the book deserves this kind of quality. And that's really what we want to offer.
Let's turn now to some of these specific books that illustrate these principles. We've got, I think, at least a dozen books in the pipeline at some stage of development, but I thought we could talk about just some of them. So again, this isn't a comprehensive list of all the books we're coming out with, but some of the more intriguing ones over the next few months. We've got, I think, three that are coming out this fall in 2023. The first Spark book is titled Saintly Creatures, 14 Tales of Animals and Their Holy Companions. Tell us about this one.
Sure. I actually have this right next to me. It's very exciting. It's our beautiful cover of the first book. So this one is by Alexi Sargent and illustrated by Anita Bargiani. And it's this compilation of beautiful little stories of saints who either befriended an animal or were saved by an animal. You know, these really exciting, engaging stories of saints from very, you know, ancient to Blessed Carlo Acutis, so very modern, and from all over the world. And so they're just beautifully written, engaging stories. And really our goal with this is that the child reading the book is inspired to be a saint, that they see all of these different ways that people live their lives on fire with love for God and think, how is God calling me to be a saint? And we were so excited because a friend of Word on Fire, Jessica Houghton Wilson, shared an early review copy with her daughter. And she said, my daughter read this book and then said, I want to be a saint. And we said, yes, that's exactly what we were hoping for.
Mission accomplished. Well, in addition to new books that we're developing, we're also going to be releasing new editions of classic children's literature that has maybe gone out of favor for whatever reason. And we're going to do that under our new line of Word on Fire Spark Classics. The first Spark Classic that we're going to release is called The Golden Key and Other Fairy Tales by George MacDonald. Tell us about this one.
Sure. So George MacDonald was a Scottish writer and minister. He was writing in the 1800s, and his stories had a huge impact on C.S. Lewis, the Christian apologist, on G.K. Chesterton, on all fantasy literature that came after him. And so we wanted to start this series with this book because his writing, I believe, was it G.K. Chesterton or C.S. Lewis who said his writing baptized their imagination?
That was Lewis.
And so I think of that as kind of the marker of this series, is these aren't stories about saints or priests or anything explicitly Catholic, but the structure of these stories baptizes the imagination. And so they're just beautiful. They have this beautiful structure of hope. And when you dive into them, you can see, oh, I see elements of these Christian themes, even if they're not, they're not hitting me over the head, but they're kind of forming the reader's imagination.
I love the idea that some of these heroes, many of whom are admired by Word on Fire followers, people like C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, J.R.R. Tolkien, it's fun to ask what books shaped them? What books shaped their imagination? How do you produce a Tolkien or a Lewis or a Chesterton? And George MacDonald, the author of this collection, is one of those answers. Let's turn now to another book we're releasing this fall. This one comes out in late November, and it's called Bless the Lord, Bless the Lord. It's a picture book, a board book, I believe. Tell us about this one.
Sure. This kind of came to mind with Word on Fire's beautiful Liturgy of the Hours project, which, you know, trying to get more people praying the hours, make it easier for people to pray the hours, to have these beautiful Liturgy of the Hours booklets. And it just came to mind, how can we help families pray the hours together? How can we offer resources for children? And so this is a board book with one of the canticles from Liturgy of the Hours, the canticle from the book of Daniel, and it's the Bless the Lord canticle. So bless the Lord, sun and moon, you know, all these beautiful images of God's creation, praising the Lord. And so our illustrator just did an incredible job making these beautiful scenes, and just the whole text of this canticle is in this board book. So our vision is that, you know, the infant or toddler can hold on to this book and flip through the pages and be part of this family prayer time or praying at Mass by having this to hold on to and engage with and participate.
What I like is that if you're praying the Liturgy of the Hours as a family, you'll pray the Canticle of Daniel pretty often. I think it's a regular part of morning prayer. And so the rhythms, the cadences, the words of this great canticle of praise will seep into your family and even the little kids. You'll begin to memorize it. It'll change the way you see the world. So I love that we're releasing prayer resources not only for adults but for children as well. All right, let's turn to another great Spark book coming soon. This one is by the esteemed theologian Abigail Favalli, and it's called Here I Am. And we actually are releasing two versions of this book, one for boys, one for girls. Tell us about this one.
Sure. Well, this one kind of was born from Abigail Favalli writes just incredible and wonderful, fully Catholic pieces and books about gender. And what is the theology of gender that's really in line with Catholic teaching? And she focuses a lot on the sacramentality of the body. And so she wanted to write a book for children that really highlights our embodiment. You know, we are embodied creatures, and that our bodies are gifts. Our bodies are gifts from God, and that when we look to Christ, you know, our bodies are kind of icons of Christ's body, as we're made in the image of God. And so she put together this just incredible board book for young children, such a big concept, and she did it in just such a beautiful way of just communicating that our bodies are gifts and kind of connecting all these ideas. So we have one version where the main character is a boy, so the child can look at the illustrations and little boys can see themselves in this character, and then another one where the main character is a little girl, so the text is the same, but in the illustrations you can see these different images. And we're just so happy with how it turned out. I think it's going to be wonderful.
I think parents are going to love this, because a lot of parents that I've talked to are really concerned about the lessons their young children are learning, either from the media, from school, from friends, about their bodies and their identity. This book, I think, does a great job communicating to kids that your body is a good thing, that your body is part of you. It's not something outside of you that you yourself manipulate. It is you. And also the Christian dimension of the body. There's a part of the story where it says God wanted a body, and so he gave himself a body through the incarnation. And so it's highlighting how the Christian identification with the body is especially distinct among all other religions and worldviews. So really good. If you're a parent that's concerned about these questions and issues, this book, I think, would be great for your kids. All right, Haley, let's talk about one final book. And again, this is just a sampling. There's many more books here that we haven't teased out yet. But the last one I want to talk with you about is a sort of kid's biography of the great scientist Jerome Lejeune. In fact, the subtitle is The Saintly Geneticist. Tell us about this one.
Sure. Well, one of Word on Fire's themes is communicating that faith and science are not opposed to each other. And that this is such an important thing to communicate when we're speaking to young people, especially. We don't want to communicate the idea that science, you can either believe science or you can believe your Catholic faith, that they're not compatible. And so we really wanted to highlight some scientists and stories of scientists who were holy men and women. And one of these is Venerable Jerome Lejeune, who was a geneticist, a French geneticist, and discovered the chromosomal component of Down syndrome, and was also a fierce advocate for the vulnerable, for every child's right to life. And so the story is really compelling of his faith, of learning all of, you know, all of his research, just all of his scientific research, and then also his advocacy. And so I think it's a wonderful story for children to be inspired by and to be receiving this understanding that, hey, Catholics are making scientific progress. Catholics are involved in the scientific spheres. And so this is something that we can see that faith and science are not opposed at all. So all of those things, you know, pro-life and saints and science all in one story. We're very excited about it.
I want to talk about a couple other exciting initiatives from Spark beyond just the normal books that we'll be releasing. The first one is a new podcast. So you've been podcasting for many years, but you're going to launch this new podcast through Word on Fire called Spark the Imagination. What's this one about?
So the concept behind this is, you mentioned earlier that it's interesting to see what books formed, you know, C.S. Lewis's imagination, what baptized his imagination, or G.K. Chesterton. And so in some ways, that's kind of the structure of this podcast, is I'll be speaking with writers, artists, illustrators to find out what baptized their imagination, what books were formative for them that really started them on this journey as artists, as Christians. And so we're going to have really interesting guests talking about children's literature, talking about books that formed them, and then from there jumping off into all kinds of children's books and books of all kinds.
I know parents are always looking for good book recommendations for their kids. In a world where there's just a flurry of new books released every year, parents can't stay on top of it. So the books that we release through Spark obviously will get our two thumbs up. These would be good for your kids. But the Spark the Imagination podcast, I imagine, will share a lot of good books parents might not be familiar with that are worth reading with your kids. All right, let's talk about one more thing before we wrap up. This, I think, will be the first public announcement of this project, although we've been working on it kind of secretly, clandestinely for quite some time. We're planning a Spark Bible, a Spark Bible. Tell us about this.
Yes, we, as a parent, I have struggled over the years to find a children's Bible that's a Catholic Bible that is just the right thing, you know, what I want to offer my kids. Either it's a Protestant Bible and I like the structure, but it's just missing some elements, or, you know, it's presenting them in a way that doesn't really line up with how we see it as Catholics. And so just wanting a really high quality children's Bible that tells the story of salvation, you know, the big narrative arc, the great story of God's love for us. So starting with the Old Testament and going all the way through the New and highlighting what are the most important stories to really baptize the imagination, again, of our children, to really share the gospel story with them so that they're then prepared to dive into the actual scriptures. So not taking the place of reading the actual Bible, but something that helps them kind of hang all of that on. You know, they have this basic form and understanding for the structure of the scripture.
So more details to come. As Haley said, this is going to tell the great story of salvation from Genesis all the way through Revelation, through several dozen specific episodes. And the Old Testament episodes, almost all of them have a direct link to New Testament episodes. So we're teaching children the typological relationship between the two testaments. We have a phenomenal writer, an incredibly talented illustrator. I don't want to share the names just yet. I'm sure those will come out soon. But we're very hard at work on this project, and we expect to finish up most of the work through 2024, and the anticipated release will be early 2025. Well, Haley, lots of exciting things coming soon from Word on Fire Spark. Thank you for all your hard work on it. I want to encourage listeners to go to the website wordonfire.org/spark. That'll be the home base for all of these new initiatives. And I think right now you can sign up via email to be updated when new books and podcasts and the Spark Bible come out. So make sure to do that. That way you're staying up to speed on everything. And then finally, pick up your copy of the first Spark book. Again, it's called Saintly Creatures, 14 Tales of Animals and Their Holy Companions. And Haley, am I right that we're offering a special deal here for the first launch group of people that get the book?
We are. While supplies last, when you order from Word on Fire, the Saintly Creatures book, you also get Grigio. So this is the little dog that was the protector of St. John Bosco. And that is one of the stories that you'll see in Saintly Creatures, and he's soft and just precious and comes with the book if you order from Word on Fire.
Very good. I want to be clear, you got to order through Word on Fire. So if you order it through Amazon or another bookseller, you won't get the free stuffed animal, but if you order through Word on Fire, you will. Well, thanks everybody for listening and watching, and here's to many more great things coming soon from Word on Fire Spark.
That's all the time we have for Catholic Radio Indy's Lunchtime Podcast Sampler for today. You can find this show in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org, along with links to more of the programs we've shared. I'm Kent Blanford, and until next time, may God bless.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.